angel to many. He hears the husk crying from the briar and reaches in her hand to see what's the matter. He's dragged through the darkness.
Hello, it's well, that's not coming through too clear, is it? It's Radio Mysterioso here for the 12th of October of 2003. And I do not know how many listeners we have. I have to check once in a while. But the message did go out that we have a guest here today, a rare guest. Mr. Bill Moore has said that he would come down and grace our presence and answer some questions. Should I close the window there with all that noise? let's see. How's the mic now?
I don't know.
There we go. Now it's on.
Hello out there.
Should I introduce you? Bill Moore has written how many books?
Oh, I don't know. Many.
Many?
Several.
Several?
More than two.
Yeah. Probably the two most well-known were The Philadelphia Experiment in 1978.
79.
79, and the Roswell Incident,
1980.
Yeah, and what in between that and now?
The Green Fireball thing, and the MJ-12 report in 91, and...
That's right.
Gosh, what else? A lot of magazine stuff, and a forthcoming volume on Mormonism, of all things.
So, I didn't write any questions down, as I told Bill in the car, because it was very busy today, and pretty much we know what we want to talk about, I guess.
Well, you asked me just before we went on the air here what I thought of the studio.
Yeah.
I said, ask me that on the air. I walked in here and was immediately struck by a memory from the long past. This is a bizarre place. I mean, if you're out there listening to this, and you're not in here looking at this... just cannot appreciate the joys of pirate radio, with windows open and traffic going by on the corner below and red lights blinking and so on and so forth. The last experience I had like this, I have to comment.
Please.
Was equally strange, and what it reminded me of was in 1979 when... we were just releasing the Philadelphia Experiment, and mm-hmm. of course we did a kickoff publicity thing of, in all places, Philadelphia. while there, I did quite a number of radio shows, and I was scheduled to do one on the campus of Temple, I believe, University, if I'm not mistaken, in Philadelphia. And I was scheduled to be interviewed by one Ira Einhorn.
Yes, you had mentioned this.
Who has achieved some notoriety over the years. So I dutifully showed up on the morning appointed, and I asked around the campus where the radio station was, and everybody pointed me off in the direction of this very ancient-looking, Victorian-style, unpainted mansion. All boarded up, and I thought, what in the world is this? Went up on the front porch. There was a little sign that said, for a radio station, push a button, so I did, and a door opened. And the radio station was on the top floor in the garret of this old house, and it looked very much like this studio right here. It was just a rather eclectic collection of eclecticy.
And posters and junk.
When I walked in here, that was immediately what came back to my mind, was that very strange experience. Anyway, Ira Einhorn didn't show up that morning. It turns out he had fled the coop due to, shall we say, entanglements with the Justice Department and others the day before.
Oh, he had left just that day?
Oh, yes. It was the day before, or perhaps 2 days before, that he had vanished. And in any case, there I was, and so I ended up taping a show with someone else who knew him. Years later...
We'll take calls in a minute. We hear the phone ring. Give us about 10 minutes.
Years later, I was the happy subject of an investigation by the Federal Bureau, who asked me what I knew about Ira Einhorn. And I said, well, I don't know much of anything about Ira Einhorn, except that he didn't show up when I was supposed to be on a radio show with him. Anyway, memories, and that was a long time ago.
I guess you did have a lot of mutual friends.
Or a few, anyway. Perhaps we did, and I know that he read some of my things, magazine material and so on, and mm-hmm. certainly knew who I was, because it was he who had asked to have me on the show. He'd contacted my publisher. So,
being
on the radio, we're not supposed to have a moment of silence, Greg. If I stop talking, you're supposed to say something. See?
Well, maybe I should have had the Coca-Cola that you were drinking. Well, what I was about to say was that he was quite good friends with Andrea Puharik at a time when he said Puharik was dealing with a lot of subjects that would have gotten him in trouble. I don't know exactly who Puharik worked for. He was good with electronics as well as doing the writing a book on mushrooms at first, and then at least one on paranormal functioning, which came out in the mid-60s. And he had stayed with Puharik for a while at his place, and he said there were strange fires there. And
yeah, they burned Puharik's place down. I think it was in Ossining, New York, or somewhere in that area.
Along
the Hudson there.
The ubiquitous they? Or
Well, I don't know who, but they, presuming it took more than one to light the fire.
Yeah.
I know there was a lot of problem around that, but I did not know Puharik personally.
Uh-huh.
I was aware of what he was doing.
Right. And I think he died in the late 60s.
I believe that's correct.
Yeah. Einhorn achieved fame in a different way. He was passing papers around from people at Bell Labs, etc., he said, having to do with classified information, and that's why the CIA or whoever was after him, and they framed him for the murder. But I've never been able to get a straight answer out of him about anything related to the murder. He tries to change the subject, and he keeps saying the same thing that doesn't connect with things he'd said before and with the facts of the case. And he tried to run his own defense when he came back for his trial, and the jury and the judge basically laughed at him, and now he's in prison for the rest of his life.
Well, it occurs to me that if sinister and dark forces within any government want to frame somebody, there are far easier ways to do it than to go through the elaborate ritual of killing the guy's girlfriend, mummifying the body, and putting it in his closet.
Yeah.
he was a very public person. He had a lot of powerful friends. It would seem to me that if you wanted to set him up and bring about his discrediting or his downfall, it might be easier to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but it's always a mystery. Perhaps it always will be.
Well, speaking of mysteries, I had asked you this before in the course of trying to write this book I'm working on, how long your interest in strange things, paranormal things, etc., goes back, and how that started.
Well, Greg,
we'll have to hold the calls until we talk for a little bit here.
There's only one possible answer to that. This being the month of October, I feel empowered to say that my interest goes back to the fact that I was born on Halloween. I'm just unusual from birth. It goes back a long way. I just really can't answer that. I've always been interested in things that were different.
Uh-huh. Also, you said something today that I didn't know, that you were an investigator for NICAP early on in the 60s?
Yes, briefly, that's true. Of sorts, I guess. I really wasn't what you'd call formally connected with their organization. I was teaching school in upstate New York in the 1960s, middle 60s, and I was merely a subscriber. And I got a call from, I don't know, it may have been Don Kehoe was the first call.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a case of a close encounter in a nearby town, and they would like to know, or whoever I was talking to wanted to know, would I go over there and look into it and write a report and send it in? And I said, sure, I'd be willing to do that, and so I did. I went over and spent an evening talking to a couple of people on what amounted to a rather interesting but rather mundane close encounter event over a wooded, swampy area, a rural area. There was radio interference involved, vehicle interference, car went, wouldn't work, and so on and so forth. So I wrote up a report. I sent it into ICAP. I got a call back from, it was Dick Hall the second time, I remember that, and he had a lot of questions about the electrical interference aspects of that case, and I guess I answered what I could. I think I looked into one or two other minor cases for NICAP after that, but didn't amount to anything. There were lights in the sky, basically. That particular case was interesting. There certainly was something involved with that.
It was something specifically that happened to this woman, and you said that it looks like something like a tube was floating through the air?
Yeah, she described a thing that looked like a tube with vacuum cleaner attachments on both ends of it, like the where you would couple the hose of a vacuum cleaner into the machine. It's got that kind of metal fitting with push clamps on the sides or something. And she said it looked like a tube with those kinds of things on the ends of it. And it appeared over some trees over a wooded area, and as it appeared, her radio went haywire, and then her car stopped. So she had to stop and look at the thing. And she didn't feel, as I recall, particularly frightened about it. She watched it for quite a long period of time. It went away. She went home, told her daughter. Her daughter insisted that they wanted to go back and look at it again. The daughter wouldn't believe it. She wanted to go back and see it. So they went back, but it wasn't there. That's basically it. You know. What else can you do with a case like that?
Nothing. Apparently Dick Hall was trying to do something with it.
He was compiling information on electrical interference and electromagnetic interference at that time. And NICAP subsequently published a book, or someone connected with NICAP published that book, little yellow booklet, on EM interference.
And I was trying to remember the author of that. Wasn't Rodiger, was it?
Might have been. I don't recall either. I don't even know whether that particular case was in it, but that's why they were interested, or he was interested in that case, because of the EM interference.
I always wondered when there was vehicle interference, why when UFOs would go by airplanes, it wouldn't stop their engines.
Good question.
It seemed like it would be the same principle at work, and it's essentially, you know, at least in early cases, with internal combustion engines, piston engines, they would have the same effect, but I've never heard of somebody's plane having all the electricity shut down and then
There seem to have been a number of cases in the early years, who knows now, but of vehicles being affected by UFOs, but it seemed to be selective. There would be sightings and vehicles would be involved and there wouldn't be any interference, and then there would be instances where there would be. And you have to wonder whether whatever was causing the interference was deliberate, whether perhaps they wanted to be seen.
Right.
Who can tell? It's not without having the thing in front of you to ask it.
Right.
You really never know.
I'm sure there's one question going through a lot of people. Well, there's probably 300 questions, but I guess we'll go historically and maybe towards the end of the show to come up to what you're doing now, if that's all right with you. We've got something like an hour and 40 minutes still. We can take musical breaks, which we will do.
I don't sing very well, I'm afraid.
Yeah, well, I'll turn the microphone down when we want you to
do duets.
I've done that, actually.
That bellering that I heard on the end of the last show there.
I think Pam Stonebrook and I sang one time on the air at the same time. She's moved to Houston now, I think.
Drove her out of town, did it?
Huh?
Drove her out of town.
Jumping forward a little bit, how did you find out about the Roswell case before really anybody was talking about it and get interested in that case enough to have a write a book with Charles Berlitz?
Oh, that's such an old story. Do I really want to take time to answer that again?
In
a nutshell,
condense it down to a paragraph is fine.
I have to credit where it's due, and that is that it was really Friedman who found the most of that early story. I'd found a little piece of it. It seemed to fit together with what he had found. But to make a long story short, we Friedman had come into town. I was living in Minnesota at that time. And we met after his presentation in a pizza parlor called Papa John's, which was then only a single place and is now a national chain. And Papa John himself served us a pizza. And we were comparing notes and just yak-yakking because I had known Stanton from Pittsburgh some years earlier. And I guess he mentioned having talked to a man named Marcel in Louisiana about a crash. We were talking about crash stories. And I said, you know, that sounds strange because I had run across some information about the British comedian Huey Green. And Huey Green had been in the United States in 1947, traveling from Los Angeles to Philadelphia, had passed through New Mexico, and had heard on the radio that there had been a flying saucer crash. And I was chasing down that aspect, and it had actually gotten in touch with Huey Green through his son in Canada. And the story had been verified, so I told this to Stan. I said, you know, it sounds like the same story. For once, we've got a crash story here where there's two people talking, apparently talking about the same event at the same time.
Right.
I said, this is something we ought to look into.
And 30 years before.
And so, yeah, we began to look into it further. I talked to Jess Marcel, and from there we tracked down. I went down to Minneapolis and spent a couple days at the Wilson Library and went through old newspaper files and dug out a lot of stuff. And it convinced us that something had crashed, but what was it? We didn't know. So that's what led to it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, after publishing the Philadelphia experiment, which I primarily wrote using material that Berlitz had accumulated to some extent, we actually did co-write the book, but it was a lot of, I wouldn't say a lot, but a substantial amount of it was his research, and I wrote the book. And Roswell was just the opposite. I wish I had written Roswell.
Had I written at this point,
it would have been a lot different. But I didn't. The deal was that I was doing... The publisher wanted it right now. They said, you know, we've got a bestseller on our hands, that we're ready to do another book. What do you want to do? So I met with Berlitz. We talked about a couple of ideas. I ran this Roswell thing past him. He liked it. We only had a few months. So I did the field work. And I wrote up field reports and sent them back to Berlitz in New York. And he wrote up the paragraph or the chapters and put them into the publisher, and the next thing I knew we had virtually a completed manuscript in our hand in galleys, and we couldn't even make changes in it. They wouldn't take changes. We may have managed to make a few where names were misspelled and things like that,
no.
But they wouldn't take any substantive changes at all. And so it got published really sort of as a kind of lame duck, but it set off a chain of events that was what I had hoped it would do, which ultimately led to extensive investigation in the question of crash saucers. Were there such things? You know, and if there were, was this the most likely candidate? And what crashed down there? I don't know. There is a certain amount of rather compelling evidence to suggest that it was some government thing at that time, that they were trying to cover up some early balloon surveillance project. But, you know, the thing that intrigued me about it all was that I was the one who went down and talked to all these people. I spent a tremendous amount of time and a lot of resources going to New Mexico to interview people, and elsewhere, all over the country, to interview people. And my approach was always pretty much the same, and that was, I'm interested in the crash of some sort of aerial object in the area of Corona, New Mexico, in July of 1947. What can you tell me? And I shut up and let them talk.
Right.
And then I ask questions. In every case, the people were talking about the same event. They were talking about this strange metal. You would ask them what was the metal like. They would describe it the same way. I didn't put words in their mouth. And not only that, they didn't know what the other people I had talked to had told me. They didn't even know that I had talked to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And in like 10 cases where I would say to these individuals, all right, what do you think this object was? You had pieces of it in your hand, or you saw it out there in the field, or... you had some personal contact with it. What was it? And in every case, they said, I think it was a spaceship of some kind. So, taking that, you know, from up front, you have to say, well, all right, 10 out of 10? Nobody's saying, oh, it was a weird airplane, or it was something the government was doing, or it was a balloon. Jesse Marcel, the first time I talked to him, he spent most of that conversation talking about how baffled he was at the gouges that this stuff had torn into the hard surface in that area of New Mexico, and it didn't weigh anything. And he said, I spent a lot of time trying to calculate how fast something that weighed nothing would have to be going to dig a gouge in the soil. And he said, I couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
He said, that wasn't dragged along. This stuff exploded, and it hit the ground and actually dug gouges in the ground as it hit. And that intrigued me. I said, well, you know, why would you notice that? And he explained to me that he'd been trained as a physicist, that he, you know, he knew what he was talking about. He wasn't bluffing anybody. He mm-hmm. wasn't trying to con anybody.
Have anything to do with the ground being wet at the time?
No, it wasn't wet at the time.
Mm.
It was dry. It was in the middle of July in New Mexico. It doesn't rain there in July.
Well, if it does, it's very short.
Right. More lightning than anything else, if it does anything. But, you know, people subsequently talked to individuals, and they changed their story. Why, I don't know, but... and then I'd get accused of not reporting it accurately or distorting the evidence or something else. Charlie Moore down in New Mexico at New Mexico Socorro Mining and Mining and Technology Institute down there. No relation of mine that I know of. But, you know, I went down and talked to him a couple of times, and we had very sober discussions, and it turned around that he accused me of misquoting him. I'd sent what I had written to him, and he'd signed off on it. How could I misquote him? I have that page.
Yeah, is he the one that brought up the Mogul balloon thing very first?
He didn't
because
bring
he
it up until later.
It?
He admitted that he'd worked on the New York balloon project, is what he called it, and he showed me some data on that. And subsequently, we checked that out and found out there had been some launches, but that in every case, the launch was either recovered or they knew where it had crashed and had not recovered it because it was rough terrain or some other reason.
Yeah.
And in no case was there anything unexplained or unrecovered in the Corona area. And
right.
That held true, in spite of what some people have said subsequently.
Mm-hmm.
Because I checked that thoroughly.
So at after all this, how do you feel about it now? How do you feel about what it was that happened there? What do you think it was?
I don't know what it was.
What are your two best guesses?
Well, it was either an extraterrestrial device or it was some other type of device that wasn't extraterrestrial. It's not much. It's a waffle, but
yeah.
That's really what it was. I don't know. I don't really know. I don't feel any more able to venture an opinion on the nature of that thing now than I did back in 1980. There's been a lot of pro and con, a lot of fuss back and forth. I used to say that the extraterrestrial explanation was the best of several explanations. I retreated on that a bit some years ago and came back and said, well, the extraterrestrial explanation remains viable.
Mm-hmm.
It cannot be dismissed. But it may not be the best one any longer. It just is an explanation. It's reached the stage now where you read the evidence and you take your pick.
Right.
Because all of the principles are dead. Many of the Johnnies come lately had nothing to offer but confusion. They were talking about things that either were highly questionable as to whether they had really occurred, or they were remembering things as young children that they had overheard adults saying 50 years earlier.
Right.
And, you know, who knows how reliable that is. So, you know, it's read the stories, take your pick. Something crashed down there. Whatever it was highly unusual. The excuse me, government got involved with it. They picked it up. What happened then is an open question. It obviously, some of that wreckage went back to Maryland.
Maryland.
At least according to... trying to think of the man's name that I talked to, who was one of Jess Marcel's assistants, who said, oh, yeah, he said, I saw the packaging when they packaged some of it up, and it went back to Fort Holabird, which was then the headquarters of the Air Force intelligence. What later evolved into OSI was at Fort Holabird, Maryland. I think it was AFCIC at that time. I think it was the 600th CIC unit at Fort Holabird that ultimately ended up. Try to find the records of that unit, and you can find nothing. They'll tell you that, yes, it existed, but there's absolutely nothing on record that has anything to do with it.
It seems a lot of these tributaries, when you follow them far enough upstream, on a lot of these things, you run into a wall, and there's no information on it. It's very difficult sometimes, I've found recently, to try and prove something with any kind of document, because the document that would kind of be the smoking gun document, like the Cutler-Twining memo, which a lot of people consider a smoking gun about MJ-12, is just not available, and it's very difficult to prove something that's, you know, evidence. the absence of evidence thing is very difficult in that way. But that's basically what you had been pursuing up to probably the late 80s, was mainly documents after about 80... When did the MJ-12 get mailed to Jamie? 83? Yeah.
Mm-hmm, in December of 83.
Why did it get mailed to Jamie and not you?
I wish I knew. I don't know.
And it was mailed from Albuquerque, which
That's
makes
correct.
A lot of people try to point fingers at Rick Doty, and he said that he'd never had anything to do with it, and he didn't even know what it was.
That's
Although
right.
he does say there is an MJ-12, but that's Rick Doty.
Well, there was an MJ-12. What it was is the question and remains the question. Certainly, of the controversial MJ-12 documents that were on that film, and the one that was subsequently found in the archives, and other peripheral materials, it becomes quite apparent, I think, is the words I want to use, that the Cutler-Twining memo of the three documents appears to be authentic. The unfortunate thing is that it does mention MJ-12, but it doesn't mention UFOs. It doesn't say what MJ-12 was, except that it was some kind of a special studies project.
Right.
But when you compare the typefaces on that and the quirkiness of the typewriter that did it, the crooked letters, weaker strikes on some letters than on others, letters above and below the line, and the make and model of typewriter with documents that came out of the Cutler-Twining, Cutler, in fact, Cutler's office.
Robert
during
Cutler.
Robert Cutler at that time, who was National Security Advisor to Eisenhower, you find that there were four principal typewriters used in generating memos in that office. Each one has a distinct and identifiable typeface, and one of those four matches the typing on the Cutler-Twining MJ-12 memo on 30-some different points. Different points. Letters not straight, above and below the line, weaker and stronger strikes, and etc. 30-some different points of similarity, which is very strong evidence that Cutler-Twining MJ-12 memo was typed on that typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, MJ-12 existed in 1954, and it existed at a very high level, and Twining was involved with it, but what was it?
Yeah, I asked you this.
Was that a deliberate disinformation ploy to take some highly black project from the early 50s and morph that somehow into a UFO thing, or was there some reality there?
I have a guest right now.
Greg is on the phone here.
Sorry, I'm the only person. I'm the host, engineer, and whatever else, producer, all at the same time. Whoops. I asked you, I think, a few weeks ago, after all this MJ-12 stuff, What has been proven except for something called MJ-12 existed in the 1950s, at least under Eisenhower's administration. Past that, what has been proven about it? The existence has been proven, but not what they dealt with.
Exactly. Exactly. If they dealt with UFOs, it is not apparent. The so-called Eisenhower briefing document now gives every appearance of being a carefully crafted piece of disinformation. I want everybody to know I didn't craft it. I certainly did not know that General Bedell Smith had an off-the-record meeting with Truman at the White House and the East Entrance or something on a specific date in 1950. That material wasn't known at all until Friedman found that on the presidential calendar, and that's the only place it was recorded. It wasn't even in his diary. So who would have known that? I didn't know that. I couldn't have used that to create a document. People accused me of creating the document. How could I have known that? The other matter is that in that document it speaks of an alleged UFO recovery on the Mexico-Texas border in the area of two little towns, El Indio and
Guerrero
is the other one. Writer Dennis Stacy, who's a friend of mine, and another fellow, Tom Dooley, who's an acquaintance and a friend of Dennis Stacy's, went down and investigated that. Found out that, by golly, there was a crash at that time in that area, but it was covered up. And it wasn't a UFO, it was an FAA training flight that had strayed over the border and went down. And they,
Civil Air Patrol, I guess, at the time.
Yes, CAA, I guess it was. They were trying to avoid a confrontation, diplomatic confrontation with Mexico about us being in their air patrol when there was some political question involved with it. And again, who would have known that? Somebody had to know that to put
right.
that in there. So if someone cleverly crafted this document, as it appears, then they crafted it with bits and pieces of real information sandwiched in with perhaps a certain amount of disinformation or misinformation. And
right.
trying to sort one from the other has proved well nigh impossible. All of the people named existed. There's been a lot of fuss about it naming Donald Menzel, the astronomer, as a member of the MJ-12 UFO committee. Maybe he was and maybe he wasn't. Friedman contends he was. I don't know. I have never taken a hard and fast statement or position one way or the other. I've always said what I'm interested in is getting to the bottom of it, not standing up and grandstanding and saying it is or it is not. And in that sense, I've always welcomed the participation of other people. I said that at Las Vegas, you know, join me and let's see if we can get the bottom of this thing.
Right.
Although I must admit that if I had Las Vegas to do over again, I wouldn't be quite so arrogant about it. I think I was just a little bit too hyped that day. But as far as the content goes, I wouldn't change any of that. The way that I said it, I think I was perhaps a bit too forward. I should have been a bit more humble. But what I was trying to say was, look, folks, you've been had. You've been had because you were willing to be had, and you were willing to mouth what was fed to you. I wasn't doing the feeding. I was the one that found out what it was all about, but they all got mad at me because I was the messenger. But at that point, I felt I had learned just about as much as I was going to learn about UFOs. We had gone to some very high levels and some things that have never been talked about. Some things which perhaps will be talked about because I've talked to my host here, Greg, who's doing his book, and I've told him quite a few things that have not been previously known. And so, you know, if you want to find them out, you have to get his book once it comes out. I'm not going to spill that ahead of time.
But, or you can
aside
go to the,
from that, you know, we
conference
went to some,
next month.
We went to some pretty high levels, and we got some answers, and the answers only led to more questions. And that is that yes, there's something going on with respect, or was something going on with respect to the UFO phenomenon. It seems now that maybe they've left, they've gone away for a while, because the cases that come around anymore just don't have that kind of flavor to them.
Right.
But there was something, there were certain elements within the military government complex that had an interest in that something, and knew some things, or had made some conclusions about that, and maybe even some contingency plans, I don't know. But most of it seems to have been hype dumped into it by people within the UFO community, the so-called research community. And it became very apparent very quickly there that these people don't want answers because they survive on mysteries. And if you give them answers, they're no longer important.
I'm kind of worried about that when the book comes out, because people are going to say, well, how can you believe all this? And it's like, well, because I was told it by three or four different people in different ways, and what else can I go on?
Well, let's make a distinction here. Some writers are believers, and others, such as myself, are reporters.
Mm-hmm.
And those of us who report don't believe. We merely report. We let others do the believing.
Mm-hmm.
Belief, to me, is a blind thing. Once you believe something, you cease asking questions about it. And once you cease asking questions, it becomes a fact to you.
Right.
And that seems to be a dead-end process. If you seek to understand rather than believe, it goes from level to level. And as you seek understanding and enlightenment, it comes to you. Mm-hmm. And doors open that you didn't even know existed before. But the moment you stop and believe, you've reached the dead end. And that's dangerous to me. Religiously speaking, the Gospel of John says, those who believe shall be saved. The Gospel of Thomas,
Doubting Thomas,
repeats the same phrase, but says, those who understand shall be saved.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference, of course, is between the belief, those who will believe blindly what others tell them and accept it, and those who will quest for enlightenment and knowledge throughout their existence and seek to understand it. It is those who will grow. The mm-hmm. other ones won't.
Yeah, well, you stop at a dead end. So, you know, as you finish these projects, did you find... I'm finding this, too. I mean, it's a growing process, but did you find when you finished Roswell, Philadelphia Experiment, when you were getting these papers mailed to you, given to you by Falcon, etc., do you find that the only thing that happened was more questions and precious few answers, if any?
Well, yes, it's true that the more you seek and find, the more you want to know, and so each supposed answer only leads to two or three more questions. you know, in the end, is it sufficient to know that there is some other presence around planet Earth than our own? Do you accept that? If you accept that, all right, then you go on from there and say, okay, I'll accept that, and how does that affect me? I'm still who I am. I'm still doing what I'm doing, and if there's an alien out there orbiting around and watching me, there's not much I'm going to be able to do about that, but I might be able to expand my consciousness out to try to include within it, and it's the consideration of the universe that I might make, the fact that, by golly, I might not be alone here.
Was that important enough to you at the time to answer that question? But it sounds like it still hasn't really been answered.
I don't know that it has.
I guess if it was answered, that would equal belief.
It becomes answered on an individual level. It depends on what you choose to accept and at what level you choose to decide that you've learned enough for this moment, then you begin to look in other directions. Perhaps in some time in the future, you know, the door will open again and we'll learn more.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, it seems to be more of a dead-end street than a quest for knowledge, because all you find is more of the same.
Right.
You can read the UFO literature, you can read the commentaries and editorials, you can talk to the people who are involved, and it's a replay over and over and over and over and over and over. There's nothing in it that gives you any more enlightenment than you had from the first half a dozen major cases.
Mm-hmm.
It tells you that there's something going on, whatever it is, and this is the key point to the whole phenomenon, whatever it is, it is able to control our awareness of it. And once you're dealing with something that's able to control how you perceive it, you're never sure of just what's real anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't know whether you're being manipulated or whether what you're seeing is in fact reality. And that's what UFOs do. They're able to manipulate our awareness of them. Sometimes they stop cars, Sometimes they don't.
Right.
Sometimes they seem to appear to only a few people, and others don't see them. You get all of these weird things that go on. Either they exist or they don't. If you decide they don't exist, you've closed the door. If you leave your mind open to the fact that they might, then you need to quest further.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you quest, the more questions you find.
Sounds like the same thing that happens with the documents.
Unfortunately, those who have gotten so personally wrapped up in the subject, suddenly they survive on mysteries
mm-hmm.
and not on answers. As long as there is a mystery, there is a need for a UFO magazine. And I underline that I just said a UFO magazine,
yes.
So as not to confuse it with an actual title of that name. As long as there are mysteries, there is a need for a UFO magazine. As long as there are mysteries, there is a need for a phenomena newsletter. Again, not to confuse that with something that actually exists.
Mm-hmm.
But questions, of course, are legitimate if you ask them.
Right.
But if you refuse to consider legitimate answers and report facts and continue to distort those things in order to continue the mystery or to try to top somebody else who's doing the same thing, it becomes an endless chain of can you top this? Well, my abduction stories are better than yours.
Mm-hmm.
My exotic propulsion machines are better than yours. Ad nauseum.
Yeah.
Where does that get you?
I don't know. I've called that stuff. It happens in any group that's involved with something, but a story, a picture, an artifact. I've started to call that in the last few years UFO porno, because people they're interested in the artifact or the idea, not where it comes from, or you know, as a fetish.
Well, I think once you realize that, yes, I am an American, but it doesn't stop there. I am also an Earthling. But it doesn't stop there either. I'm also a Milky Wayian, or perhaps a Sagittarian Clusterian, or you know, you can take it as far as you want. But the point is that you can narrow your existence and place yourself in just as small a box as you want to, and thereby limit yourself. Or you can recognize that you're a citizen of the galaxy and the universe, and that if there are aliens out there, okay, why not? Meanwhile, what's that got to do with your quest for your own spiritual enlightenment, your own future, and your own purposes?
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps something, perhaps nothing. If you happen to be walking down the country road and a UFO lands on the street in front of you and an alien steps out and said, good morning, come with me, then it certainly has affected your life. But until that happens, you need to find other things to keep you busy.
Yeah.
It's like winning the lottery.
Uh-huh.
You might buy the ticket, but you better keep busy because you might just not be the one selected.
Right. We haven't taken a break yet. I want to do that. Some people have been trying to call, at least early on, and I wanted to give Bill a chance to talk uninterrupted for a while. Let's take a break for a few minutes here with some music, and after this, when we come back, we'll take a few calls, maybe for 15 or 20 minutes, and then talk again after that.
Only intelligent questions, please.
Yes. And that's assuming the phone is working properly, which is a whole other question we'll have to deal with when the first call comes
in. My agents have seen to it.
And we'll be back with Bill Moore in the space of a couple of songs here. Meanwhile, here's Louis Prima.
My baby's gone on a trip to the moon, and she won't be back too soon. She doesn't write me and I can't sleep. All I hear from her is, my baby's up in a rocket machine. Since she left, she ain't been seen. She doesn't call me and I can't sleep. All I hear from her is, I wonder if means I miss you. Or maybe means I want to kiss you. I'm hoping that means I love you, and she's coming down to earth again. My baby's high in the stratosphere. I'm so low cause I'm down here. My love for her is gonna keep till she comes back and whispers.
wonder if means I miss you, and maybe means I want to kiss you. I'm hoping that means I love you, and she's coming down to earth again. My baby's fooling around with a satellite. Now you know that that ain't right. My love for her is gonna keep till she comes back and whispers. My baby's fooling around with some space cat. That chick don't know where she's at. She better come on down here to earth and groove. I ain't gonna move. I'll lay that sound on me, honey.
If you want to get a thrill, if you want to see the sights, jump right in. I got an unidentified flying object. Yeah, let's go for a spin. Let go in UFO. Wet, dry, and salt supply. We glide across the sky. Nobody will believe their eyes. Just when they think they've seen us, we zoom away to Venus. One moment we're in Mexico, like that we're over Idaho. Just tell me where you wanna go in my UFO. We're going UFOing. We're trying salt supplying. We'll glide across the skies. Nobody will believe their eyes. Just when they think they've seen us, we'll zoom away to Venus. One moment we're in Mexico, like that we're over Idaho. Just tell me where you wanna go in my UFO. Going UFOing, we're trying salt supplying. We'll glide across the sky. Nobody will believe their eyes. Just when they think they've seen us, we'll zoom away to Venus. One moment we're in Mexico, like that we're over Idaho. Just tell me where you wanna go in my UFO. We're going UFOing. Trying salt supplies, we'll glide across the skies. Nobody will believe their eyes. Just when they think they've seen us, we'll zoom away to Venus. One moment we're in Mexico, like that we're over Idaho. Just tell me where you wanna go in my UFO.